we've seen so far about this topic of pshara. And we see that pshara is kind of a unique din, what you might call itself a pshara of a din, in that it is a hybrid, maybe. It has properties that go in two different directions. Because on the one hand, it's different than din Torah. It's not a horah in the same sense, because it doesn't involve clarifying a din in the Torah. This whole Tosfos that we saw about not accepting Rove was very useful for us to speak out a number of possibilities as to what this reflects about Torah and about Pshara. And one point that emerged is that there's a difference between Pshara and Din Torah. When it comes to a Din Torah, we're clarifying halachic points which could impact on other cases, which could set a precedent for future generations, which could be recorded in the Rambam of the Shulchan Aruch. And we don't have such recordings in our Shulchan Aruch, because it's not going to be relevant for future iterations of the Halacha. So Pshara is different than Din Torah as far as that's concerned. But, at the same time, it has enough in common with Din that you shouldn't think that it's just random, or that it's just split things down the middle, and that it has no rootings in din. It is a psak shel lifnei mishuras hadin. So it is a psak, it is a horah, but it's a horah in a different sense. So that could have various implications. So on the one hand, the Rav mentioned in his shiur that the concept of a zakin mamre, and the idea of a dayan, the chacham, who paskins against the Sanhedrin, and is chayav nisa for doing so. So that requires that we're dealing with a psak, we're dealing with a horah. Right? If you recall, we saw that that's why the Rambam requires smicha to be a zakin mamre. So by the same token, it's unlikely that there'd be a concept of zakin mamre when you're talking about pshara. Let's say the Zakin Agadol would get involved in some situation of pshara, and one Zakin would disagree, so you wouldn't call them the Zakin Mamre. You have to figure out how you get a psak, but that's a different story. But you wouldn't call him the Zakin Mamre because he's not arguing on the kind of psak that becomes canonized halacha for generations. However, in the other direction, Rav also pointed out that all the other dinim that associate themselves with psak probably apply here as well. So, for example, losa kirupanin. Right, let's say one of the balei din is a friend of yours, or is a distinguished person. So you might think, okay, I should factor that into my decision. Not permissible. Or let's say to accept shofar, right, to take a bribe from one side or the other. The same way that that's a significant problem for din, it's going to be a problem for pshara also. Hi.
Krovin and all that is also.
Well, krovin would have the same status that it have with din, which is the bali din can accept that. Right, so this is mistaber, that should be true here as well, that if the people come and accept a karov or one of them as somebody's going to pshara, presumably should also be affected. Now, one point that need a little bit of clarification is, all right, so we said you can't accept a bribe, and you can't show preference for somebody who's friendly or somebody who's poor, or somebody who's distinguished. But what about somebody who's poor? Actually, so if we're saying that Lefnim Meshuras Hadin, so Lefnim Meshuras Hadin, as we discussed last week, could include the incorporation of other cheshbonos. Right? And those other cheshbonos can come from other areas of halacha. So if we have a halacha of tztaka, so like you saw from the Gemara of Rabbi Bar Hanan, where it seems like the fact that people he was dealing with were poor, and he was rich, that impacted the halacha as far as what he was told to do. So, how do you reconcile that? Right? Should you say that, okay, if you have a normal din Torah, so the Torah is explicit in the Pesukim, that you can't decide, I'll make the poor person win because I have Rachmanis on his poverty. So does that change if it's Pshara? In light of what we just said a second ago, that Pshara should have the same basic trappings as did, in terms of Shokhan and friendships and distinguished people. So should we make an exception for a poor person because of the din of tzedakah and rachmanis?
So we would say something like, still pshara has to have a rational basis to it.
Mm-hmm.
The din, maybe they were a little more strict in removing aspects that can seem like leaning towards one way or another against din. But for pshara, we're allowing more of extra factors to factor into the rationality of pshara.
Okay.
So we're still making sure that there's a din aspect that's not random, that's not splitting it down the middle, but we're allowing more considerations as part of the psak process, the psak is a din. That's what I'm getting at.
So, if I understand you correctly, I'm not sure I do, you're saying that, it's potentially an interesting comment, I just want to make sure I understand you, that you're saying that the fact that one side is poor becomes a type of rational factor. Is that what you're saying?
Perfect.
So I think there could be some truth to that. I don't know if we have enough to say that or not. So I think you could theoretically say it one of three ways. You could say that, no, there's no exceptions here for poverty, and that's not the kind of thing you can factor in at all. We have to account for some sources of some stories, which would sound otherwise, but that's one approach you could take. That's not a part of pshara. Trying to decide how much to say. This morning, I was asked a shayla halacha l'maisa by somebody, trying to skewer the details, but he was questioning whether he should get involved in a legal dispute between two parties. And he had whatever reasons why he should or he shouldn't. And he said two things. He said that one is that he thinks the party he's seeking to possibly help is actually being victimized, that the other party is actually cheating them. And also that this party who he wants to help has a hard life and is a very nice person, and the other person is not such a nice person. So he's trying to explain that the idea that you believe justice is on the side of one of them, that one is a victim. So that's a legitimate calculation for what he was thinking of doing. The fact that you also think that the victim has had a hard life and is a nicer person, that's not really legitimate as far as whatever shaila he was dealing with. So you have to isolate those factors. So you could say, theoretically, that this is not a legitimate factor to enter into the pshara equation, although we have seen some sources and some bases to say that it is. So if we say that it is, so then that could lead us to two other ways to look at it. One is, maybe like Ari was just saying, that let's separate that out from what we just listed, that this is not like favoring a distinguished person or accepting a bribe or favoring a friend of yours, but this is something which has a svara al pidin, that there's actual mitzvah to help out the impoverished person, and therefore that could be factored in. A third way, which I think might be a little bit more likely, and which also clarifies the second way, is that you could include this in the psak. You could say that basically, I think this is how the different elements play out. And you, Rich Baldin, you should also recognize that because you have an obligation of Rachmanis on poor Baldin, therefore also we're deciding along these lines. And be more explicit about it. Which is also helpful in clarifying another point, that if we're going to say that Rachmanis and Staka should fit in here, it doesn't mean that the Dayan is going to say, well, I have Rachmanis, I personally, the Dayan, have Rachmanis on the poor person, so I'm going to tilt things to make them win. But rather, it means that I think the other Baldin has a mitzvah to have rachmanis on this litigant and should feel an obligation of stucker towards that person. So the logic that's valid is when the dayan feels that stucker and rachmanis should come to one litigant from the other litigant. You follow the difference? Right, the dayan is not just saying, okay, well, here I have an opportunity to give this poor person a windfall, so I'll skew the din in their favor. That would be a legitimate. And that would be a legitimate, probably in din or in shar. But if what the dayan is trying to do is trying to tell the rich litigant that he has an obligation of rachmanis and staka, and therefore impose upon him a responsibility, a moral responsibility, to take care of the poorer person, that still wouldn't be possible within din, but within shara, maybe that would have a framework. Okay, does that make sense? Tamir?
We're working off this because shara is the same shara for that?
Right, correct. So basically, the question we're trying to answer is, if we just said that you can't have things like bribes and favoritism, so then we shouldn't also favor the poor. That's what the Torah says. You can't favor the poor and did. So how do we reconcile that with some implications that we've had that with Nimashar's din does favor the poor? So that's what we're trying to answer, that maybe that's what we mean. Okay? Make sense? Any objections, Shmuley?
You go over the first possibility again?
So the first possibility is that maybe we don't make a difference to that. Maybe we don't allow the dying to factor in poverty. And that all of these things, they can't factor in. So it's not a part of it. But we've seen indications that that's not true. Like including that Gemara about Rabbi Bar Hanan. And it sounds like poverty is a factor. Or relative poverty. Poverty on the one side and wealth on the other side. So how can we explain that? So we gave two possible ways to say how we could possibly include that. Okay. So further along these lines, the Soloveitchik also asserted that when we said that this is a psak of what the Mishra said, that this is not random, and it's built on halakhic principles, and which he also extracted from the language of the short Tosfos here, that requires, if you call Tosfos Ramaskal Tiski, that pshara nami tzricha hefer das, right? That it's not just a flip of the coin, but it needs actual decision emanating from Das. So the Rav apparently objected, as I just saw today. I was looking, when I was quoting from the Rav in Tilna, I was quoting from the original ones. I looked today at the version that was published more recently. So there, quote the Rav is saying that the phrase, which we mentioned the other day, of Pshara HaKrova L'din, which you find invoked by Bati Din today, the Rav felt it's basically redundant. That the idea that there's two types of pshara, that there's stam pshara, and there's pshara hakrova l'din. So the Rav is quoted here as rejecting that distinction, and saying that every pshara is krova l'din. That's what a pshara is. A pshara is something that's going to be based on principles of din, and just applied with factors of lifnim mishuras of din. So if you recall, this would go against the statement of Rav Sternbach that we mentioned last week, that Rav Sternbach thought that maybe you could follow a road for Pshara HaKrova L'din, and only not follow a road for Stam Pshara. So according to the Rav, that whole distinction he felt was objectionable. Okay? So far so good? Everybody with us? Okay, so now the Gemara gets into the question of whether or not Pshara needs a king. And we have the opinion of Rav Ashi, right, that it shouldn't need a kinyan. And then the Maskan is not like him, that we do need a kinyan. So let's try to figure out how this kinyan plays in. What exactly is the significance of this kinyan? So why would you need a kinyan? Why should Pshara need a kinyan? Right, assuming Stam Bezdin doesn't need a kinyan. So why should Pshara? Are you?
It seems to grant authority or obligation upon the litigants to actually do what they have to do once the...
Okay, so that's probably the most intuitive approach. Right? That the purpose is that we need to make sure they're actually going to follow through with this process, with the results of this process, so therefore the Kenyan is going to establish that. So let's assume for a second that's correct. So why would you say that Rav Ashi disagrees? Let's try to understand the opinion of Rav Ashi, if that's really what a Kenyan is for. So why does Rav Ashi feel we don't need one? How come according to Rav Ashi you don't need a Kenyan? What is going to be mechayev the litigants to observe the psak if there's no Kenyan? Sammy?
Just their verbal agreement to
So it would seem like the verbal agreement is a factor. We have to explain exactly how that works. This is something the Rav addressed also. He said you might have thought that it's the psak itself. The psak of this bezdin is going to have authority and they're going to have to listen even without a king. But he felt that that was difficult. Because even when you have a full-blown bezdin and they issue a ruling, it's not really the psak that is mechayev. Really what obligates in the case of the bezdin is the fact that they have established the facts of the din. And now that they have clarified that this is the din, so then that creates the obligation to follow. So if that's the case, so here, you don't have that. You don't have an establishment of facts al pi din, because like we've said from the beginning, that's where Peshawar differs from din. So how it comes out is that in a regular Bezdin, the Bezdin's word is not really what is creating the obligation. But in the Peshawar Bezdin, it is. It's a little hard to believe. The Peshawar is a stronger Bezdin than a regular Bezdin. Morty?
Could be just like our Kibbutz.
So that's, I think, along the lines of what Sammy was saying. What do you mean by Kibbutz?
Well, in the Kibbutz, you said that when a real beast makes a ruling, that that psak is mechayev, but it's because they went through it al pi din.
Right? Okay, right.
But for instance, you could Kibbutz based in that isn't that like, to do that, right? Meaning parents aren't able to do that.
Right.
I thought they were different.
Right, you're saying, you're talking about between the Kabbalah Dayanim?
Yeah.
That also? So you're saying, so clearly, that is here even without Krovim, right? The fact is that they are willingly accepting this Bezdin. But one could have said, okay, if they're willingly accepting it, then they should need a Kenyan to signify that's what's happening. So if you don't need the Kenyan, then what is it that's signifying that acceptance that you're referring to? How is that acceptance happening? So it could be, the Rav thought, that it comes through Amira. Now, it's important to understand what that would mean. All right, normally, Amira is a tricky kind of kinyan. Because Amira basically is not a kinyan. Amira, in some places, alludes to the possibility of certain things being nigna through Amira. Right, but normally, the whole point of kinyanim is that you need more than speech in order to be mechayev yourself, in order to create an actual binding obligation. So here he suggests that this is an idea which is associated with a well-known ritva. The ritva in his chidushim, the Bab Mesiyah and Dafayin Gimel. This is a great ritva to know. And there's a lot more to say about this ritva, halacha l'maisa, because it's very significant. And it's the kind of thing that could come up in a lot of contemporary Dinei Torah. And indeed, it has been the subject of a lot of analysis by later Batei Din. That the Ritva seems to suggest that if I say something to you, and you take action based on what I said, so then I can become financially liable for what you did. So I remember thinking about this. Now we're in the midst of an election, and it's a very hotly controversial election where we have the possibility of third-party candidates and alternative candidates and people dropping out and the like. So I remember many years ago when Ross Perot was running as a third-party candidate. So you guys are probably too young to remember this. But Ross Perot eventually did decently for a third-party candidate, did better than any third-party candidate had ever done before. That's why Bill Clinton was elected as a minority without a majority of the vote. So Ross Perot had started running and then dropped out and then came back in. So during the time when he dropped out, there was this woman who wanted to sue him because she said that she had taken on campaign activities because he said he was running, and then he said he wasn't running, so she felt she had a case. So at the time, I was thinking that this seems to be drawing on the Ritva. I don't remember her explicitly quoting the Ritva, but this idea that I'm sure she had in the back of her head, that if somebody takes actions based on something you're saying, so then maybe there could be a liability for that. So here, how does that factor in? That if you tell the other party, you know what, let's go to this Beis Din and we'll accept their pshat. The other party says, okay, I'll do that. And then together, you go to this Beis Din and cooperate with the whole process. So therefore, because the other one is doing something based on your say-so, maybe that creates a machai. Okay, so it could be. And so perhaps that's what's going on here, that Rav Ashi's position is that you don't need a kinyan, and you don't need a kinyan because you're obligated to follow the ruling anyway because of your initial commitment. So then, let's ask the question the other way. So if Rav Ashi is correct, so then why do we need a kinyan? What's the purpose of the kinyan then? What do I need an additional commitment for? If I am indeed already committed because of what I said, so then why do I need an additional level of kinyan? What's the kinyan for now? Right, so if we've seen that it was intuitively correct to say that you needed to commit yourself to Lipsak, but now we saw that there's basis to commit without the kinyan, so what else could the kinyan be there for? And what other considerations could the kinyan be there for? So here is a notion which we have any opportunity to talk about the third parak, so we'll talk about this more. But there's a concept called asmachta. Right? What does asmachta mean? So asmachta is,
relying on something that doesn't exist.
Well, relying on something that may be a mistake. Yeah. So essentially, not to be confused with the asmachta usage. The Gemara says that Din Darabanan is connected to a pasuk. It's called an asmachta also. It's a totally different usage of the term. But the idea of asmachta, which comes out in the third parak, is the reason to prohibit gambling. And the idea of an asmachta is that, let's say somebody obligates to give you money for something. If X happens, they'll give you money. So normally, that should be a deal. Okay, you do this job, I'll pay you. You give me this item, I'll pay you. But what if the contingent event is an unlikely event? Or has some other reason why the person who is committing doesn't really think it's going to happen? And therefore, the commitment could be lacking in full intent. So then we worry that that's not actually binding, asmachta lo kanya. And for one to collect on that, he's basically taking money illegitimately. Right? And that's the problem for gambling. Because gambling, the person says, okay, if you win the game, I'll pay you. And we're worried that he doesn't really want to pay. He only said that because he didn't think he was going to lose. And now he finds to his surprise that he lost, so he's giving the money over unwillingly. So when the other party takes it, maybe that's considered to be some level of theft. So you could say here that maybe there's an issue of asmachta. right? That maybe the person who commits himself to the pshara is doing so under some degree of misconception. Now here is something I wanted to discuss for a minute. So the way it's explained in the notes of the Rav, that the reason this might be a misconception is because in essence it's kind of a gamble. Comparable to the gambling example we gave a second ago. That really this person could have gone to a din Torah and could have insisted on din Torah. Why does he agree to pshara? Because he thinks maybe he'll do even better in pshara land. And then when he finds out that actually he's not doing better the way he thought, so then maybe he would have never undertook it in the first place, such a commitment. So you're going to take money from him under a false premise. So I'm a little uncomfortable with that formulation. Right, Eldar, why am I uncomfortable with that formulation?
Because you can, anytime you go into the case, you have to expect that there's a chance you're going to lose.
Okay, but we say, fine, if it's the din Torah, and then you have no choice, you have to go to the case. But we could say, here, you chose to enter into a pshara form because you thought it would be better for you, and you didn't realize that it's not actually better for you, and because you had the right to not do it in the first place, maybe we should worry that that's all under a mistaken premise. So who's up first there? Okay, are you then worried?
Part of the issue is like you can't commit to anything, really, that you don't do like a full-on kinyan for, meaning like we're going to pay somebody later, agreeing for services or something like that, because that seems to be a gamble on the future. What if you don't like what he did, or he disagreed with his, painting skills or something like that?
Well, that's not necessarily a question, right? Because you could say, let's say you pay somebody to paint your house, right? So when things go as expected, so then if, let's say, the person does paint your house in every normal sense of the word, so then it's clear you're obligated to pay. Right? So the fact that there might be some dispute over the quality of the work or whatever, so in a hanami, that dispute might end up being arguable. Right? So you don't have to come on to hasmachta for that, because if the job is done under expectations, so then there for sure isn't hasmachta. And if the job is done in a way that differs from expectations, then taki may not have to pay. So for either side, you don't really need hasmachta for that. A better example of smacht in that case, let's say the painter says, I'm telling you, I'm so sure I'm going to get the job done by Tuesday. So if I don't get it done by Tuesday, you don't have to pay me anything. Right? Or I'll give you $1 million penalty. So then it's clear that, it could be clear, depending on how it's phrased, that he's saying that because he's sure he's going to get it done. He doesn't have any intent to accept that penalty. And then when the situation actually happens, so now he's surprised, and he doesn't really want to give the penalty. So here, the concern, the way the Rav is phrasing it, is that you didn't have to enter into this kind of setup. Maybe you only enter into the setup because you thought you'd do better than you did with a din Torah. And therefore now we see it's under false premises. So what bothers me about the formulation, and maybe it doesn't have to bother us, maybe we can just sharpen things a little bit, is that I don't think that's necessarily the reason people enter into pshara. And it's certainly, hashkafically, not why we would tell someone to enter into pshara. Right? When the rabbi tries to convince litigants to take a pshara instead of a bezdin, the way our Gemara concludes that he should, right? So he doesn't say, go for pshara because you'll probably end up getting more. Right? Especially since he's talking both of them at the same time. So he's not basically saying, let's have a gamble here. Each one of you, if you take out the din, you'll only get a limited amount of money. But if you go through pshara, maybe you'll get more, and who knows what it'll be, so pit your skills against each other, and each one of you thinks that you're going to get more, then that would talk to be like gambling. But I don't think that's what happens when we advocate pshara. But hopefully when we advocate pshara, the parties know, I may not get as much as I would have gotten in din Torah. But because it's consistent with Lefnim Meshur Sadin and the principle of Emes V'Shalom that our Gemara uses on Vav Mitbeis, another way of saying Lefnim Meshur Sadin, So the person acknowledges that that's a higher ideal. Right? I'd rather live with Nimishur Sadin, and I'd rather live with Emes Mishalom than get every last dollar I could. So then where's the Asmata?
Okay. You can't always know someone's intention. It's the same thing with gambling. If you gamble, you know there's a huge chance you're going to lose, but then you just Asmata, and there's plenty of people that hold that way. When someone goes, he's going to lose. So you never know someone's intention when he's going into the Bishara.
Alright, so I think you're on the right track. I think just to sharpen this whole point, it's that it's not that the person only goes into Peshara because he thinks he'll get a better deal. Hopefully the person goes into Peshara because he believes that that's simply a better way to live. But we're not sure, and it's possible there could be a mistaken premise when the person goes into it, or even if there's mixed motives, it's possible that they thought that they would get more than they're actually going to end up getting, and that they're going to be surprised by how the din turns out, how the pshara turns out, and that somewhere there'll be a feeling that this was a mistake, feeling that this was not what they signed up for. So perhaps that's in general what we mean by asmata. Right? But you could argue also with gambling, as many do. Well, what do you mean? He doesn't think for sure he's going to win. People know he's gambled before, he's lost before, and he knows that people lose when they gamble. It's hard to believe that every bet they take, they only enter in with a 100% expectation that they're going to win. So perhaps in both cases, the understanding, to sharpen a little bit more, is that asmata doesn't mean that it's for sure an open mistake. It means that there's a mixture of motives and a mixture of expectations going in here. And it's not similar, to go back to Ari's question, it's not like hiring somebody to paint your house, where there's a pretty clear vision of what you expect to happen and what you expect to follow through. And therefore, maybe we need to have more of a concern. Another reason to consider this specifically in Asmachta, even more than the other examples we're familiar with, so Tosfos later on in Daf Chav Hey raises as an issue of Asmachta when you are Tola B'das Acher. When you create a situation where it's not even up to you to bring about a certain result, you're going to invest in somebody else's decisions or in somebody else's actions. So that's even more a concern of asmachta, and that supports the idea that that's what we're concerned about. So the Rav noted also that here, just like Psak Shulafim Mishur Sadin, so we don't find that phrase in our Gemara, and we have to use other stand-in phrases. So on Vav Mudeis, we have the phrase of Mishpat and Shalom, and the Tosfos line that we focused on here was Hechra Das, as a way of saying that it's an actual Hora and not just a random division. So what phrase? We don't really find the word Asmachta in our Gemara either, or in the Rishonim here, on the Dot, right? So what phrase, if you've seen the Mar Makomos today, what phrase from the Gemara or the Rishonim that appear on our daf do you think is the stand-in for asmachta? What phrase do you see somewhere on our Tzuras Adaf that is probably a way of saying asmachta? Give it a minute. I'll give you a hint, it's in the Tosfos. Now, what phrase in the big Tosfos on the bottom of the page is probably a way of saying asmachta? I'll give you another hint. It starts with the word mechila.
Lokanya.
Okay, so that would be an interesting phrase. But another one that's here. Mechila betos. Who said that? Yes, correct. Right? That maybe that's what we mean when we say mechila betos. That essentially the person who is getting involved here, apparently there's some degree of mechila, that's what emerges from Tosfos' whole discussion here, and that's why that's going to be a topic we're going to segue into after this, the whole question of a person waiving his rights. So Tosfos is assuming that the mechanics here are that the person who's agreeing to pshara has to basically implement mechila in order for that to happen. that because I'll feed in Torah, I could insist on more of a payout from you, and I'm willing to forget about that. So that's a usage of mechilut. That's my being mochel on the rights that I otherwise had. So the kinyan is there to address the fear that this is a mechila betos, that this mechila was a mistake. So said the Rav, what's that code for? Or what's that another phrase for? That's asmachta. Asmachta is a concern that, oh, when you agreed to pay the person who wins the bet, it was betos, that you never thought you were going to lose. So through here, we're worried that maybe, yes, you said you'll suspend your right, you'll waive your rights to get all the money you would have gotten. That's because you didn't know how it was going to turn out. And when you see how it's going to turn out, then you have charata. So that's potentially mechila betos, which is asma. So that same Tosus on Daf Fei says, if we're concerned about asmachta, because let's say it's kolu v'das acher, so then a way to deal with that is with a kinyan. And when you have a kinyan, the bezdin chashuv, so that's going to address concerns of asmachta. So talking about this on Shabbos, those of you who were with us last year, recall that we spoke about the prenup at length, and the prenup, which we recommend everyone signing before getting married. So the prenup obligates the husband to support his wife even if they are separated until such time as the marriage should be ended off again. So one of the objections that has been raised is that it's a problem of asmachta, is that it's a concern that maybe when the husband signs such a document, that he didn't really think that he was going to have to follow through with this consequence. And therefore, we should say that it's not a real obligation. So there are a number of responses to that, why it shouldn't be considered as asmachta. This is not the only one. But one of the ways that it's dealt with is the prenup itself says that this is considered to be a kinyan in a bezdin chashuv. So when you have a formal process of signing on to it in front of the Besdin, so then that can counteract the concerns of us now.
Gambling?
Well, theoretically, yeah. Right? If you were to sign up, go to Besdin Chashuv and say that, you know, we are coming to our Besdin to manage our gambling. You probably imagine some kind of sketchy place where they have a Besdin for gambling. But I guess, you know, that's probably the ultimate in novel versus October, right? You work out your yeshivish gambling so that you have Bezin Chasha sign off on all the asmachas. It's a good Purim parody, I guess, theoretically. It's hard to imagine how that would work, but I guess theoretically you could have such a thing.
Can a Bezin Chasha not be part of the Yishuv Olam?
Right. Still be a possible results for either. Yeah. Possible results for Dayanus. That would definitely be great Purim parody. So you missed it for this year. Definitely what to explore over there. But yes, it doesn't come up so much in the context of gambling. But this is an example of where it might come up, right? Maybe you have a real agreement, which a Bezdin would be involved in, such as a Pshara, or such as a Prenup, where in case there's any concern that you don't have full das and commitment, so then the kinyan should establish that that's not the case. And again, when it comes to the Prenup, there's a lot more to say about that, but that's just one of the ways to forestall any objection of asmachta. So the kinyan should help. And if that's the story, okay, so that should explain everything. That we're worried about asmachta, the kinyan is going to address that. So just so you follow the progression here, right? First we thought that we need the kinyan in order to get the commitment to listen to the psak in the first place. But then we saw, like Ravashi's opinion, that there's a way to explain that commitment even without a kinyan. So the kinyan is for something else. So what's it for? It's because of the asmachta concerns. But the story is not over. Because at least according to the Rambam, if you saw the Rambam was on today's Makoros, a kinyan doesn't help for every type of asmachta. and maybe shouldn't help in this situation.
All right, what's the Rambam's position I'm talking about?
When is the kinyan not going to help? If it is a sum, it's called she'eino katsu. That if you're committing to some number, that you have no idea what it is. Right, it's one thing if you're gambling, to go back to that as your desired kinyan situation. So in our fictional Beis Din L'Inyanei gambling, so there, at least when you take a bet, so you know what you're committing yourself to. If you lose, it'll be this much. Okay, you don't think you're going to lose, but if you do lose, you know what it is that you're saying you'll pay for. But here, you have no idea what these dayanim are going to say. And you have no idea what number they're going to come up with. So according to the Rambam, you can't commit to a sum that you don't know about, even with a kinyan that's going to be asmah. If we combine the fact that it's contingent and that it's unknown, then you have a real asmah the problem, according to the Rambam, and one that transcends even kinyan. Ari?
Could you say that potentially if you dispute for $10,000, you could lose $10,000? What? I mean, it's not really, you know, you're not going to be kind of more money than you, than is involved in the case.
Yeah, it could be. I was thinking that also, that maybe you say that it's not limitless, because you assume that there is an upper limit to what it should be, and that maybe that this kinyan should be effective, that you're willing to go that high. So.
But maybe someone's going to this case isn't willing to give up the entire.
Right, so I think that's one possible answer to that. I think there's two ways to answer that. First of all, as people sometimes find when they enter into disputes in general, that actually obligations can come from all kinds of random places, and that they don't actually have a picture of just how far their losses can go, even though they think, okay, this is the whole thing, but then they find out that there are damages and there's some kind of penalty, or whatever it is, that it could actually be the numbers transcend what they think. Or, I think like you're saying, that it could be that even if there's a number that's the upper limit, you don't think there's any kind of realistic possibility that it's going to come anywhere near that limit. Because if there's a pshara, so let's say here can draw on the common conception, even if it's not true. So let's say people walk in thinking, oh, pshara, it's going to be 50-50. Right? And they can think, all right, we're talking about $10,000, so it's going to be something close to $5,000. And then when they find out, based on what we've seen here, that a pshara could end up being 100-0. Right, theoretically, the Dayanim Poshrim could say that there's no basis here to deviate at all from the Ikar Adin, and the Ikar Adin is you're totally chayef the other guy. So even Al Pi Pshara, they could come up with such a complete difference from what the person coming in expects that maybe that also counts as a Dover Shana present.
And if we're going to say a Dover Shana concept, at least you have like a range. Then I mean, everywhere has a range. The judges aren't going to ask you for a couple million dollars if you're someone who's incapable of doing such things.
But you're saying if that's not called a return of cost, then there's no such thing as a return of cost.
There's always going to be a range. There's no the maybe. Base is not going to ask you for an infinite amount of money.
Yeah, maybe. Let's hope.
Hopefully. But, so, like, there's always going to be a range, whether it's huge or not huge.
And yet, there's still a concept of the
Roshan.
Okay. Could be. But here, the Rav addressed this question, based on the Rambam, and said that there is an important distinction to be made, which, again, fills in a lot of what we've been leading up to, that this commitment and this mechila, this whole process that you're signing on to with your kinyan and your agreement, it's not that you are signing on to any amount of money. Right? It's not that once the dayanim end up saying, okay, you have to give the other guy $1,000, that you are committing to the $1,000. And you're being mechila on the $1,000 and making a kinyan on the $1,000. That's not what's happening. All this process of commitment is to the das of the dayanim, that you are agreeing to sign on to their interpretation of what should be. And then the details are what flow from that. So we would now consider that hey, skum she'eino katzuv, but rather, this is in front of you. You are agreeing that these dayanim should make the decision, and that's where the commitment is attached. So this suggestion of the Rav, I want to suggest a few parallels to this. One is that the Rugged Shaver has a comment, which seems to tie into this question. The Rugged Shaver comments on our Gemara over here on Bava Med Aleph, a few lines above what we're just looking at now. Right, the Gemara says, six lines from the bottom, Amar Avach, Abrendu Avika, Yusem Rav Yemer Bashlamya, Manda Amar Trey, Afilu Chad Nami. That the one who says that it could be two, he actually agrees that it could be one. Right, there's no real significance to two dayanim, in the positive sense. We called it Bezer Chatzah before, so two dayanim doesn't really have any significance. Either you need three, or one is also good. So what's the significance of two? So maybe we want there to be two, so they can also be witnesses. So the Rugged Shaver says, witnesses to what? Witnesses to the psak? Or witnesses to the fact that they are being relied upon? So essentially that dovetails with what the Rav was saying. Right? That you're not signing on to the final number. Where maybe you could raise an objection of Dabur Shayna Katsu, but rather you're signing on to the Dayanim themselves.
Yes, sir. What were the witnesses for?
Well, that's the question. What the Rugged Shaver said?
What did the Rugged Shaver
say? Right, so he said two possibilities. Either they're there to testify on the psak, or to testify on the fact that they have, the Bali Din, have relied on these judges. So the Rav would say, the second one. And that's what we're trying to commit to here, the fact that these Dayanim are getting the reliance of the parties, and that's what the Kenya is meant to accomplish, and therefore it's not a problem of Dabur Shayna Katsu. We'll also note the Shach. The Shach has some new days that I don't think I gave you this to look at, but I can give it to you for tomorrow. That the Shach writes, that he quotes from Maharam Lin, that the point might change if the Bali Din decide to make a pshara on their own. Which, believe it or not, that actually happens sometimes also. Right? Let's say if you have two Bali Din who decide they don't need a panel to supervise, but they will come up with a pshara on their own. So then the Shach quotes Maharam Lin, you don't need a Kenyan then. So according to the Rav, we'd understand, right, that the Kenyan is not on the details of their agreement. It's on the fact that they are trusting these third parties, these Dayanim, to adjudicate the matters. So if they don't need any third parties, if somehow miraculously they're coming to a peaceful resolution on their own, it's then okay, then there's no need for a Kenyan, because that's what it's meant to address. Okay, so this gets us to the Baha'i. Bahag, who posts his quotes here, saying that the Kenyan is after the Pshara. So that we'll have to discuss a little bit tomorrow. But let's just review what we spoke about today. So we saw the ways in which Pshara is both din normally, but it's still different. It's not an actual clarification of halachos that will affect generations. So on the one hand, it's different, those like imamri, things like that. On the other hand, it's the same. So you'd have rules like, well, sack your punim, and don't favor your relatives, and don't take shochet and the like. And then we ask, what about nani? How does nani figure into that? Because in the case of din, you can't favor him. And we had three suggestions, basically. That you could say, no distinction, nani also you can't favor. But we've seen indications that you can favor a nani, or you should favor a nani. So we suggest either that that becomes a rational policy, so bring some of them sure it's a din, so therefore it's different from all these other considerations, or maybe in a chanami, that it has to be conveyed to the Bali Din, that that's what's happening, they're being told to engage in Rahmanas, and we said that if the Dayan feels Rahmanas and wants to skew things, to give a little extra money to the poor guy,
that's not right. But if he's trying to say that the other litigant has a chiyuv towards the notzdaka, so then that's a whole different story, and that would be legitimate in a shara context. And then we talked also about the Rav saying there shouldn't be any distinction between stam shara and shara krov ladin, and that was at odds with Rav Sternbach, who mentioned last week, who made a distinction between the two as far as Rove is concerned. Then we got into this question of Kenyan, and then we asked, what do you need the Kenyan for? And it was suggested that you need the Kenyan to commit them to following what happens. And then the question of what is Rashi, why does Rashi feel you don't need this? So it could be because this is the decision of the Beis Din. We know that that would put it in a strange relationship to Din itself. So rather it could be that it's the Amira, that each side says to the other, you go to the Beis Din and I'll follow the conclusion. So maybe like the Ritzvah Bav Metzia, when somebody does something based on your telling them to do it, maybe that's considered to be something that is machayev you. So then the question is, so if that's the case, Ataka, why do you need a kinyan b'halacha l'maisa? So we'll discuss the possibility that's out of the concern of asmachta, that since here maybe they thought they'd get a better deal, that's why they agreed, and that's not happening, so maybe we have to worry about asmachta. We sharpened that a little bit, not today. Only doing it because they thought they would get a better deal, but maybe that somehow mixed up in the motives, or even with purer motives, they still thought it would come out in a different way, so maybe it would be a problematic commitment. And also, as Tosfos later on points out that you told the Bedas Acherim, all the more so that's considered to be Asmachta, so maybe the Kenyan, as Tosfos there suggests, is to address Asmachta, and Tosfos over here doesn't use the word Asmachta, but uses the phrase the chilo betos, which seems to be a reference to the idea of asmachta. And then we said the Rambam seems to cause a problem too, because the Rambam says that even a kinyan doesn't help if it's a davar she'enu katsuv. So to that, I mentioned the Rav's explanation that you're not committing to the number, you're committing to the dayanim themselves. And we saw that that was a suffix the Rambam Shofar had about our Gemara, where the Gemara says that you need two. According to the opinion, they need two. Two is just there, so you have two witnesses. So what are they witnessing on? Are they witnessing the psak? Are they witnessing the reliability? And the Rav would say the second one, they're witnessing the reliance on them. And then we mentioned, finally, the shach, the quote from Aram Lublin, that if the parties come to a pshar on their own, then they don't need a kenyan, and that also is consistent with the view of the Rav, that it's not about the number, but rather it's about the relying on these dayanim. So if they're relying on themselves, then they won't need it. Okay, so we'll pick up from here tomorrow with Avraham Mincha now. Again, remember tomorrow, treat tomorrow like a Thursday, including the laning, whatever else you do. But as far as shiur purposes, shiur is non-Tuesday time tomorrow. No early Tuesday. We'll meet here, you have a full morning.